I'll be taking you through an introduction to behavioral medicine in general, which is essentially the worldview, the system that you'll be working in. It is the predominant view of medicine in most of the settings that you'll be in. And then we're going to focus specifically on how to change health risk behaviors, giving you tools, clinical skills. I love skills. I'm a skills geek. I love at the end of a day thinking I have a new skill. It's something you can point to. So hopefully by the end of these two lectures, you'll have a new skill in getting people to change their behavior. That's a pretty good one because it's really useful if you can think about how to break down behavioral change into small units that you can use to change a range of behaviors. So we're going to focus on smoking, but the idea will be to apply the concepts we talk about to other health risk behaviors as well. But just to start, let's think about behavioral medicine. What does this mean? It's essentially a whole school of thought of how you modify behavior. How do you modify health risk behaviors? And these types of health risk behaviors are associated with increased mortality, morbidity. You will, without a doubt, have to deal with this. So as much as you think, oh, psychology, I'm going to be a surgeon. I don't want to think about psychology. This is a waste. You will have to deal with changing your patient's behavior, encouraging them, motivating them, getting them to move in the right direction in terms of healthy behaviors. So the skill sets that we'll talk about today are ones that every single one of you will have to know in a clinical setting. So what are some of these big behaviors? We talked about them yesterday too. Overeating, not exercising, a sedentary lifestyle, substance abuse, smoking. These are all very common health risk behaviors. You're going to see them a lot. So you're going to want to be able to address them with your patients and to feel confident in your ability to affect change in your patients' health risk behaviors. So we talked about a lot of different cognitive behavioral therapies and tools, and we're going to come back to some of those ideas today when we focus on smoking cessation. So in the behavioral medicine model, which is really the biopsychosocial model, the patient is not a passive victim of disease. The patient does not get put on a conveyor belt through the waiting room, through your clinical exam room, and come out healed. Okay, the patient is an active participant in their health care. When they leave your office, they will either engage in a set of unhealthy behaviors or healthy behaviors, which will defeat or support both of your goals. So it's not simply enough to give patients advice to tell them what to do. You're also, as a physician, being asked to help and encourage them adopt those recommendations into their life. So they're not passive, they're active. You don't simply tell them as a passive recipient of information what to do. You work with them as an active partner to change their behaviors. So the emphasis on treating the whole person, not just the symptoms. Now you've probably heard that a lot. We'll talk about it in our physician-patient relationship lectures as well, that you're not treating symptoms, you're treating a whole person. And in this worldview, the biopsychosocial model, this idea of mind and body, it's really, there's no difference. You're treating the mind and the body. The mind is the brain is the body. It's very difficult for me to see a distinction anymore. So when you change behaviors, you're essentially changing the body and changing the brain. So this distinction is kind of hard to, the more you go through medical school, the more you learn brain, cognitive neuroscience, the harder it is to make that distinction. But yes, you're treating both the mind and the body when you work with a patient. And you have to consider psychological and social factors. Now, this wasn't always the thinking. It's essentially that, okay, if you give a patient a drug, that's all you can do. If it doesn't work, well, you tried. It's a lot more complicated than that, that there are a lot of psychological and social factors that you have to take into account. Something as simple as addiction. Back in the 70s, was considered, so if people take addictive drugs, they become addicted. That there's some inherent property of addictive drugs that makes them addictive. And anyone who takes them will become addicted, and they may even take them or use them to the extent that they ignore eating and drinking and taking care of themselves, and you know they essentially lead to morbidity. So this is a strong view of addiction based off a purely biological model. And this is just an illustration, just to make a point. It's not in your slides, but I just want to tell you about the Rat Park studies, and there happen to be these cute illustrations online, so I'm going to talk you through them. But at the time, there was research that was looking at rats self-injecting morphine, and they found that if they allowed rats in cages to self-inject morphine, they would keep doing it, essentially not eat and drink until they died. So that reinforced the idea that addiction is just biological. But there was a researcher who essentially had problems with that. So, you know, the idea that drugs were inherently addictive and that if you give them to anyone, they'll become addicted is a biological model. But Bruce Alexander was a researcher. He thought about it a little differently. He said, well, these rats are in solitary confinement. They're taken away from their friends. They're not given any stimulation, enrichment. And these are the type of rats that they're being experimented on that actually need that social enrichment. So maybe, essentially, these rats are sitting in these cages and there's nothing else to do, and they kind of drug themselves into a haze because they're bored or deprived. So he thought a lot about their social environment, and he assembled a team of researchers, Bruce, Barry, Robert, Patricia. They got together and they said, okay, we're going to do this experiment, and we're going to test morphine in rats who are in cages, who are isolated, versus those who are in this rat utopia. They called it Rat Park. So they built this enclosure here, and they populated it with playthings, and they put the rats together, and they could, you know, have their nice fragrant cedar shavings and nest and fight and mate, and then the other rats were put in these cages. And they gave them a morphine solution. Essentially, none of the rats would drink it at first. They had to make it sweeter. But as they made it sweeter, they found that those in the cages were ingesting at much higher volumes the morphine solution, up to 19 times higher than those in Rat Park. So the cage rats seemed to want to put themselves into a drug-induced haze, whereas the Rat Parks, they weren't so interested. They preferred actually a life in their little social utopia there that was free of drugs. So they basically had three points that come from, that were derived from this, is that essentially the drugs are not inherently addictive, that they had to actually coax the rats into drinking it by adding sugar and by basically forcing them into isolation, into cages, to get them to become addicted. So where am I going with this? What's the take-home message for the biopsychosocial model of medicine? That when people are living in a nice environment, when they're socially enriched and good housing, that they're less prone to become addicted to, in this case, morphine or its cousin heroin. And that essentially it wasn't an inherent property of the drug, but biopsychosocial factors could impact the extent to which these rats became addicted. So he didn't want to generalize from the rats to humans, because that was some of the big mistakes that were made in the 70s, going from these, you know, self-injecting rats to assuming that humans would all become addicted in a similar way. But he then went on to say, okay, so yes, if we change the environments, that's one way, if we change the social environment. But another implication of this research is essentially how patients think. And this comes back to what we were talking about yesterday, how patients view their world. So maybe it's the same world. Maybe if we look around, some of you see it as Rat Park, and other of you see it as, you know, more of a cage. It's just a perception, and cognitive behavioral therapists work with the perception and the belief and try to change that. So that's a psychological aspect. The social aspect is, of course, where social workers come in and try to get people in better housing and get them in more secure or enriched environments to reduce the likelihood that they use drugs or become addicted. So that's thinking about addiction and drug use, which you'll come back to in your addiction medicine lectures. But with smoking, it's still an addiction, and you still have to think about what are the social and psychological factors that can contribute to smoking addiction, and how can we address those therapeutically in the physician-patient relationship. So one important thing to think about and to always be aware when you want to help your patients change is to remember that change is a process, that the key ingredient is patience, that you can't send them out into the world and expect them to come back changed. You might get one, maybe two patients in your life where you tell them to quit smoking and they come back and they say, I quit. But most of the time, it's going to be a long process. There's going to be failures, setbacks, relapses, and you have to have a long-range goal in mind and constantly be there supportive for the patient to reach that long-term goal. So it's a process. This change will involve, in terms specific to reducing health risk behaviors, that the change will involve the elimination of these destructive behaviors and the promotion of a healthier lifestyle. So it's not enough to say, don't drink or smoke, or don't drink too much, and don't smoke. And it's another thing to promote a healthier lifestyle, getting them to exercise, getting them to eat better, and to practice safe sex. So, and change has to involve your partnership with the patient, that they, in order to adhere to their medical regimens that you are prescribing, you want them to, you want to be their partner in that that treatment plan, that you're essentially having them, they feel they have a good relationship with the patient, and you can monitor their adherence to whatever recommendations you make. So changing these types of health risk behaviors is an important goal, but again, it requires patience and understanding. So for those of you who need the quick fix, who need to just have the patients do what you say and come back healed, it's going to be frustrating. But for those of you who understand, it's a long process, it'll be a little bit easier. Most of you will feel very confident by the end of med school in your diagnosis and treatment skills. It's a little bit harder to feel confident in your ability to motivate change in your patients. So I'm hoping that by giving you stepwise programs and breaking down change into a series of steps, it increases your sense of efficacy as a clinician to enforce change. So any complicated task, right, you just break it down into a series of steps. So even something as complicated as behavioral change. So we're going to focus on health behavior change, and we're going to provide you with guidelines for clinicians working in the process of changing health behaviors. So we've talked about that with yesterday when we talked about contingency management, this kind of rewarding good behavior, reinforcing good behavior, and, well, not so much punishing. Clinicians don't often punish. I think I'd like to think of it more as just reinforcing good behavior. So you can use that to encourage your patients, like a contingency management program, to encourage your patients to adopt a healthier exercise regimen. So you'll see this in a lot of the hospitals that you'll work in, where they have wellness programs that are incentivized. So you might get points. Your insurance program might have incentivized wellness program. You have a reduced premium if you participate in a wellness program and show a certain weight loss or show you, that you reach certain wellness goals. So that's a contingency management program when there are incentives, rewards for good behavior, for health-promoting behaviors. Overeating, we talked about stimulus control treatment, and yesterday we talked about for insomnia, CBT for insomnia. There's also stimulus control treatment for insomnia. They're pretty much the same thing. And now, today, we're going to focus on smoking cessation. So some relevant concepts that you'll know very well by the end of these two lectures are the stages of change model. The stages of change model by Prochaska and DiClemente is widely used, and it's used for a variety of different health risk behaviors and in affecting behavioral change. And you'll know how to deal with relapse prevention, how to encourage patients to maintain smoking cessation once it's achieved. And hopefully you'll feel some confidence in your ability to do motivational interviewing, which is a specific type of clinical interviewing that helps you enforce or affect change in your patient's life. So now we're going to go specifically into smoking cessation. And one of the things that will be important in the beginning of working with a patient is to provide some general education about smoking that they may not know. Most of them know. Most of us will know this already, but in case they don't, to remind them that it's very common. So there was essentially a big change in the prevalence of smoking in the past decade. It was about 25% earlier in the early aughts. But now, in 2015, it's 15% in the U.S. smoking. So there's been a big dip. For public health geeks, that's kind of fun because it showed that public health initiatives really made a big change. And now 15% of Americans smoke. Worldwide, it's more like 20 to 25%. So it's still a big issue. Most of the people who come to the clinician will say that they want to quit. Tobacco use is the leading preventable cause of death in the U.S. So one of every five deaths could have been prevented if you could have encouraged patients to quit smoking. That's why it's a big deal. So most smokers will continue to smoke despite adverse health effects. So even if they're sick, even if they have lung problems, they'll still smoke. It's highly addictive, right? 70% of smokers will see a physician each year, and a physician's advice to quit significantly increases cessation rates. So this is a key role for physicians. Now, these are important factoids for your patients because there'll be a lot of resistance to quitting smoking. So smoking cessation has health benefits even in elderly patients, patients over the age of 65. So they can say to you, oh, I've smoked my whole life. Is it really going to make a difference now? And you can say, yes, it will. It does make a difference. If patients quit smoking, they will immediately decrease their risk of lung and other cancers, heart attack, stroke, other chronic diseases. So essentially, the moment they stop, there is increased health benefit. Now, that's important to remind them that it's not like, oh, I have to quit for 2 years before I even experience any benefit. They may not feel the benefit immediately, but statistically, you can just tell them that you are putting years on your life when you quit. After 10 to 15 years of abstinence, overall mortality rates for smokers approach those who have never smoked. I think this is a highly motivating factoid because this says essentially you haven't ruined yourself, you haven't spoiled yourself because you smoked your whole life. After 15 years of abstinence, essentially the health risks go back to baseline. It's very motivating for patients. And that, of course, this translates into longer life expectancy. That's not always super motivating because, you know, it's a long-term goal and people want short-term gains. So, but you can remind them of that. So it's also important to remind them that the majority of people who smoke don't stop on their first try, that relapse is the rule. About 30% of smokers who receive state-of-the-art smoking cessation treatments, like what we'll talk about today, which is basically the state-of-the-art smoking cessation approach, 30% won't be smoking a year later, but 70% will resume within 3 months. So again, relapse is common, highly common. So it's to be expected. Now, you might think 30% is not a lot, but remember that only 5% of smokers who try to quit without assistance will succeed at 1 year. So that's a big difference. So your participation in smoking cessation for patients will improve the numbers substantially of those who succeed in at least at a year in quitting smoking. So there's two treatment approaches to smoking cessation that have demonstrated efficacy. Pharmacotherapy, and then we're going to talk about nicotine replacement therapies and two approved drugs for smoking cessation, and counseling, CBT. So we're going to focus on programs that combine these two because the combination results in the highest rates of cessation. So it's not enough just to put them on nicotine replacement and send them home. That some degree of behavioral or psychosocial considerations is needed. Why? Because smoking is learned. Everything we've talked about in the past 2 weeks, me, Dr. Kirkby, it's a learned behavior. And so in order to change a learned behavior, it takes time. There's no quick fixes. And it also involves both physiological and psychological determinants. So it's not just addiction to nicotine. There's also psychological components that you have to address to change behavior. Again, successful treatments address both. So now I don't expect you to know the answer. This is just to get you thinking about some of the predictors of smoking cessation success at 1 year. What helps? What can you look to? What demographic factors, social factors, psychological factors in your patients can you think about that will predict smoking cessation at 1 year? We'll go through them all together. So don't feel pressure to know the right answer to this because that's what we're learning here now. So the age of onset of smoking, the younger they start, the higher the likelihood of physical dependence, right? So the more years they've smoked, the harder it's going to be to quit, the higher the physical dependence. Gender is the only one that actually has no effect. Okay? So gender doesn't have any effect on smoking cessation rates. The length of prior smoking cessation attempts. So why would that matter? The length. If they were able to quit for a longer period of time, that is associated with less physical dependence. So if they're quit for longer, that's a good prognostic sign. Their level of nicotine dependence, of course, is the most proximal. And how do you assess that? We'll talk about that later in the lecture. Social support. So the more social support, the likelihood of smoking cessation. So when I mean social support, people are saying you can do it, and they're not smoking around them. So if they have a spouse that smokes or friends, all their friends smoke, of course, that's not going to help. Depression is a poor prognostic sign. So if they have depression, that should be treated, and we'll come back to that, but that should be treated before you can expect smoking cessation efforts to have a positive effect. The higher the education, the greater the likelihood of smoking cessation. And so there are some biologic predictors. Not that you'll know this when you're sitting down with a patient, but just in general, their genotype can genetic variation in dopaminergic system opioid receptors can impact their level of physical dependence. So some people, you know, just smoked, and you probably have friends, and they just didn't seem to have that dependence, and other people do. There are certain biologic factors that contribute that. And, of course, I have to come back to this because it's a recurring theme. The greater the prefrontal, in this case, thalamic connectivity, the higher the likelihood that they'll quit. Why? Inhibition of a learned behavior. So it's a habit. If you want to, so it's been reinforced in terms of operant conditioning. Smoking is reinforced, right? If you want to change behavior, change contingencies, you need the frontal lobe to inhibit a prior habit, a prior learned behavior, and to reinstate a new one. So that's, again, what makes us different from animals. We have this big prefrontal lobe, and that can help us in terms of behavioral change. Okay, so this is an important slide, and we're going to keep coming back to it because it's going to help organize our thinking. This is our stepwise model of how to affect smoking cessation in your patients. So step one is assessing their readiness to quit. Now, I want to go ahead and say this from the start because it's been a point of confusion for students in the past. When you assess a patient's readiness to quit, that can mean anywhere from I'm totally ready, I'm going to quit, you know. Well, it could range from I don't want to quit, I'm not interested, I love smoking, to actually I already quit and I'm trying to maintain it. That's how broad the range is, okay? So for people who have no interest in quitting smoking to those who've already quit and they need help maintaining it. So assessing the patient's readiness to quit spans all of these in a sense, because if they come to you and they're in a maintenance phase, then you don't have to assess their physical dependence. You don't have to look at their psychological and social determinants or even design a treatment strategy. You're just preventing relapse. So this is a bit confusing for students. When we learn this model, most of your patients, you'll assess their readiness to quit and they'll either be kind of not interested or kind of interested or getting interested, and that's when you do all of this. But if they've already quit and they're in the maintenance phase, then you just jump to preventing relapse, okay? So I want to say that from the start to try to clear up confusion. And now we're going to think about these different stages of readiness to quit. And this gets to this Prochaska and DiClemente stages of change model. It's also called the trans-theoretical model in the internet and the literature. That's how you look this up. It's a very commonly used model for changing health risk behaviors, and it helps you think about where patients at in terms of change. So are they in the pre-contemplation phase where they're essentially not interested in quitting? Are they thinking about quitting and all the health risks, and they're aware, but they have a lot of ambivalence? Are they actually preparing? Are they taking action, or have they already taken action and you're trying to help them prevent relapse? Okay, so let's talk about each of these in a little more detail. So in the pre-contemplation, a patient comes to you in the office and you're always supposed to ask about smoking. Every one of your patients that you interview, you want to ask about smoking. And that's just a general guideline for all physicians. So sometimes you say, do you smoke? Yeah. You're interested in quitting? No. I love smoking. I don't want to talk about that. Okay. That's tough for physicians, right? Because you know you're going to have to talk about it. So at some point, and this is really difficult, you're going to have to introduce some kernel of doubt. I like to think about the movie Inception. Somehow you have to insert some seed of doubt that smoking is the end-all be-all, and get them thinking about smoking cessation. But you can't push it, you can't lecture, you can't tell them, what are you doing? You have to just introduce a kernel of doubt and let it kind of fester until you meet with them again in the pre-contemplation phase, okay? So they don't see a problem. You might want to take some time to educate them, some of the factoids that I read to you before. But again, try not to lecture, because you know when someone's not interested, it's not going to go in. So it's a delicate situation, but you have to kind of read the patient and find or think about one of those factoids that might actually plant that kernel of doubt in their minds. And listen, ask them why they smoke. Ask them what it does for them, what it brings to their life, because that's also collecting information that you'll use later. So if they say, all my friends smoke, I love smoking, I smoke in the morning, it feels good, I can't imagine life without it, right? That's giving you information that you'll use later when you design the smoking cessation program, because eventually you're going to get them to that point. So you educate them, you talk about risks and benefits of smoking. So in the contemplation phase, what differentiates contemplation from pre-contemplation is they know they need to quit. They're aware at this point. That little seed maybe you planted before has festered, and they're thinking about quitting more. They might actually bring it up to you, but they have a lot of ambivalence. So your patient, it doesn't even matter what they say. You'll hear blah, 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 but blah, 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 blah. That's ambivalence. When they say, I want to do this, but la da 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 da. Okay, so essentially those are ambivalent statements. You know, I'd love to quit smoking, but I really like going out and with my friends, and we all smoke. Or, I understand that smoking is taking years off my life, but it helps calm me, and my life is so stressful right now. I really need it. Those are ambivalent statements, okay? And they kind of fall in these, you understand what I'm saying with that, right? This kind of category of da-da-da, but da-da-da. Listen carefully, because you're going to reflect those ambivalent statements back to them, but you are going to emphasize the positive health-promoting side of the ambivalence. So you're going to build, strength, and bolster their desire to change, and you're going to try to downplay their desire to stay the same. So when we talked about dialectic behavioral therapy, it's like accepting them where they are, reflecting, but at the same time, slowly pushing them in the right direction by reflecting back what they just said, but emphasizing the importance of change and the desire to change. Because using their own words, so that they actually think they feel that way, because you're encouraging and using their own words. So in this case, talk about the risks and benefits, help strengthen their self-efficacy. So when I say use their words, basically remind them, this is something you would said you would like to do. Here are some tools to help you do that. Focus on past successes. Remind them of how they've been successful at changing certain aspects of their life in the past. So say you have a patient who comes to you. Let's say a 28-year-old woman who grew up in a really poor neighborhood in, let's say, Boston, South Boston, and everyone in her life, maybe Irish or Italians, they smoke and it's just a part of their life. And she says, I have a kid at home and I'd like to quit smoking, but it's such a big, important part of my life. I have a really stressful life. Then again, I've worked so hard to get my kid out of the neighborhood into good schools, but that takes a lot of effort. I'm doing it on my own. I can't imagine not smoking. So you heard some ambivalence, right, in there. And you also heard some strengths that this patient had. So you want to reflect back. Well, I hear that it'd be really hard for you because everyone in your life smokes, but I also hear that you're someone who is really good at changing and making your life better and serving as a positive role model. So maybe by affecting this change, you can actually change the people in your life, because you appear to be pretty good at that if you got your kid out of the neighborhood and all that. So you're listening carefully to their story, listening to what they're telling you, and reflecting back their strengths and their motivation to change. That's in the contemplation phase, where you're reflecting back their ambivalence. Preparation is when they're ready. Now it's time to set the quit date, the date they're going to quit. You're going to set realistic goals, and you're going to be there with support and encouragement, and you're going to consider action-oriented programs. So these are programs like formal smoking cessation programs. And we'll come back to that a little bit in terms of the smoking cessation plan. But in general, the preparation stage is when they are ready and you have all the information ready to give them to actually enact their plan. Action is now they've made modifications to their life, they've quit smoking, and now you work with them to identify high-risk situations and then help them develop coping strategies. We're going to come back to this part as well, but in general, to think in the action stage, now you're really helping them identify anything that might trigger a relapse and providing some self-efficacy, promoting and reinforcing them, reminding them how they're strong, they can do it, that sort of thing. Maintenance stage is now they've then quit for a while, but they're still not out of the risk zone because they are going to be in situations that might trigger them to smoke. Again, relapse is the rule, so a physician always has to be aware. Don't just think because they quit, you don't ask about it anymore, that you have to assume that at some point that relapse might be a clinical issue. Okay, so let's think about those different stages, and if you can pinpoint where this patient is in the stages of change model. Okay, so this question makes it a little easy on you because it gives you specific words that point to a stage, right? So we see she's asking for help with setting a date, designing realistic goals, and strengthening her support system. So that really points you to a specific answer, which would be the preparation stage, right? So if she was in the contemplation stage, she wouldn't be ready to set a date. She'd be more like, I'm thinking about it, but... Right, you see something in the stem that reflects that ambivalence. And if she was in the action stage, she would have already quit. So it's not that hard to differentiate. Some of the stages that are a little more difficult are, you know, pre-contemplation and contemplation. And what I can suggest for that is if a patient has basically no interest in quitting and you're just giving information, but they don't have any ambivalence, they just don't want to quit. That's pre-contemplation, but contemplation is when they express that ambivalence. So now we're going to think about how you assess physical dependence as a physician, okay? Because that's going to be important for designing their smoking cessation program. At this point, you've figured out where they are, so you know what kinds of information you need to provide, but you want to assess whether they are highly dependent on nicotine or not so dependent, and it's more of a psychological type of smoking behavior. So what are some nicotine withdrawal symptoms? Irritability, anger, impatience, restlessness. They might have difficulty concentrating, difficulty sleeping, increase in appetite, and anxiety and depression. Of course, the problem with anxiety and depression is that it can serve as a discriminative stimuli to get them to smoke again, which we'll talk about. But so that's a problem. The withdrawal symptoms, there's a couple of problems with them. One is that so when they experience the physical the withdrawal symptoms, then it's going to make them, there's going to be a strong withdrawal effect that make them want to quit smoking, and if they have depression and anxiety, it's going to be so aversive, and they've used smoking to cope with anxiety and depression in the past, so it'll make them want to smoke again. Another problem is they're kind of nonspecific, and they vary between people, and most patients won't recognize what they are. They won't recognize that they feel that way because of the withdrawal from nicotine. They're usually strongest like a couple of days after, but then will reside or, will kind of calm down after 3 days. So yes, most pronounced 2 to 3 days later, but will slowly wane over the next, let's say, few weeks and months. So it might not be as strong after the third day, but they might continue to experience some withdrawal symptoms for up to weeks or a month. And that will depend on how dependent they are. So what are some indications of their physical dependence? So how dependent they are? the presence of withdrawal symptoms, and the more intense and the more withdrawal symptoms they have, the higher the likelihood that they are physically dependent on nicotine. If they had difficulty quitting in the past, then that is, again, a marker or a sign of increased physical dependence on nicotine. The number of cigarettes they smoked and their level of nicotine. So if every cigarette has about 12 milligrams of nicotine and the body can only absorb about 1 milligram, you can think about like the number of cigarettes they smoke is essentially getting more nicotine in the body. I mean, we know that the problem with cigarettes is that the cigarette companies try to put chemicals so that your body absorbs more nicotine, so it gets kind of more bang for the buck. So the tar and the carbon monoxide are all the problems with cigarettes, including the addictive component, the nicotine. But because the companies put these toxins in to increase your body's absorption of the nicotine, then that also causes, or those are what put patients at cancer risk from all these toxins. So when you give a nicotine replacement, it's essentially giving them the nicotine, but without all the toxins. So if they smoke a lot, that means they need more nicotine to feel good. So that is a higher level of physical dependence. So there's a questionnaire that you can give patients to assess their physical dependence. And it asks questions like, how many cigarettes do you smoke a day? How soon after awakening do you need that first cigarette? Does the person smoke more in the morning? What's their favorite cigarette of the day? What would be the hardest to give up? Do they smoke even if they're sick? Or do they smoke in places like airplanes, which is totally nuts because, you know, it causes big problems. But if someone is so addicted, they could go in the airport, the airplane bathroom, and try to smoke. So why is it a sign of physical dependence if they smoke in the morning? Anyone know or want to guess? It's higher with, you're right, because they've spent all night sleeping, they haven't had the nicotine, so if they wake up and they need it, their body's going through a little bit of withdrawal. So if they find that so pleasurable in the morning, it's because they've essentially been withdrawing, and so they find it really feels really good. So people that they enjoy that first cigarette more in the morning, that's a higher sign of physical dependence. So there's nicotine gum. These are all called NRTs. So for the rest of the lecture, when we talk about NRTs, we're talking about nicotine replacement therapies. What are the FDA-approved nicotine replacement therapies? Nicotine gum, the patch, the nasal spray or a vapor inhaler, also lozenges. It's not here, but people can use lozenges. E-cigs are not FDA-approved as a therapeutic device yet. But these are the FDA approved, so this is what physicians will incorporate into their smoking cessation programs. NRTs will double long-term cessation rates and relieve withdrawal and craving. So it's not enough to provide the psychology for people, the psychological help or the support and encouragement. For people who have high physical dependence, you also need to address that by giving nicotine replacement therapies. So there's also two smoking cessation products that are FDA approved. One is bupropion, which is essentially Wellbutrin, antidepressant, but for smoking cessation is marketed as Zyban. And so it acts on the dopaminergic and noradrenergic systems. And similar to depression, it can, you know, help patients feel better and thus need to smoke less. And then there's Chantix, which gets a lot more controversial press because there's some side effects like nightmares. Some people, there's also been a report of suicidal ideation, so it's banned for pilots and air traffic controllers. But these are the two approved drugs for smoking cessation. All right, so we made it through the first part of this lecture fairly quickly, so you have a bit of a longer break than usual, but we'll come back and finish up your smoking cessation skills in the next hour. Do you want to start now? Do 10 minutes?
Yes.
It confuses the system a little bit. But I know, I'll put the slide up. Okay, I got it. Yep. We can do that. We can do that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've thought about how we assess a patient's readiness to quit with the Prochaska and DiClemente stages of change model. And we have discussed how you assess physical dependence, right, with the Fagerstrom nicotine dependence scale, which you can give your patients and ask them all sorts of questions that will help you determine their level of nicotine dependence. Now we're going to think about what do you ask for and what do you assess in terms of the psychological and social determinants of addiction. We're going to make this fairly concrete. Again, reminding you, smoking is learned. It's a habit. It becomes associated with all these different discriminative stimuli. When we talked about eating, when we talked about sleeping, it's the same concept. Because it's a primary reinforcer, then it essentially becomes strongly associated with all these discriminative stimuli, social occasions, eating, relaxing, sex, drinking alcohol. So that's a lot of associations, and that means then when people are exposed to these situations, it might be a trigger then for wanting to smoke. So again, these situations can trigger the desire to smoke, and that's based off of classical and operant conditioning. We can think again about why. Because this is a concept that you've heard now quite a few times, but some people are still struggling with, this concept of negative reinforcement. So we're going to think through it again. So cigarettes are commonly used to handle stress, anxiety, depression. When you smoke, what happens? Depression goes down, anxiety goes down, stress goes down, anger goes down. So we're thinking about it as a reducer of negative states. And then when you have these, like let's say an internal state, like for example, depression or anger, that can be just as powerful as a discriminative stimuli as a social environment, right? That it can trigger the desire to smoke. And because smoking brings down the level of unpleasantness, it's considered negatively reinforced. Now, that's very confusing. And some people have asked me, I don't understand. Smoking, if it brings pleasure, if it's pleasurable, isn't it positively reinforced? I find that confusing too. But the actuality, it's actually reducing anxiety and stress. Why don't we all smoke? Some people find it gross. Why do people find it gross? It doesn't reduce their anxiety or depression. Other things do, right? So not everybody gets addicted to smoking. It doesn't work for everyone. For some people, it's very effective in reducing their anxiety and depression. And that's why it's a negative reinforcer. So why do we see higher rates of smoking in psychiatric patients? It's bringing down their psychiatric symptoms. So I hope at this point that that's clear, but if anyone still has problems with this concept of negative reinforcer, it's a good time to go through it because we have a few minutes left and it's an important concept that you see a lot. Is it clear that when you reduce the negative state, it's considered a negative reinforcement? Great, okay. So I like this quote by Prochaska, don't try to change, train to change, okay? So it's not like you just go to tell your patients, go try to change. You help them train to change, right? And you're their partner, it's like you're their coach, helping them through the long process of change. So you're helping them break learned behavioral patterns and establish new coping patterns, right? New coping skills. So some of the most common cognitive behavioral treatment approaches to doing this are stress management. Why would that be helpful? Because instead of using smoking to reduce their anxiety and stress, they're going to use other things. You're going to teach them and encourage them to use other methods, other healthier coping mechanisms. Assertiveness training. So if they have a hard time because their spouse is smoking or their friends are smoking, it's essentially training them in how to assert to be a positive role model for other people in their lives. Relaxation training is the same concept of stress management, that teaching them to relax and they don't need the nicotine as much to do that. Aversion therapy, we talked a lot about, and it's a little bit less efficacious because it's based off of more of you train them to find it aversive. So essentially you have them rapid smoke until they get nauseous and then they associate smoking with nausea, and that would be an aversion therapy. But you can imagine for some patients, they're not going to do that on their own. They're going to smoke and they're going to feel good and they're going to say, forget this. I'm not going to smoke 10 cigarettes. I mean, they're motivated, but that's not, it's actually, it would take a lot to get them to do that. Some people recommend every time they have the urge to smoke, they take a rubber band and they snap their rubber band on their hand to give them a little bit of pain, a little bit of shock. That's actually a therapy I've heard of. But again, aversion therapy is, I feel, a little less effective than positive reinforcement and encouragement. Relapse prevention is another important concept, and we'll talk about that a lot towards the end of the next lecture. Now I have to let you go for your 10-minute break, and we'll come back and finish this. Okay. What's that? We do? Oh, I have 3 minutes. This is good. This is. I thought we wouldn't have enough time. We have so much. Okay. So you must really like this. We talk about stress management. See, lots of cognitive behavioral therapy, right? You really like this. So stress management, right? This would include, these programs would include yoga, meditation, qigong, for those of you who know what that is, more of a Chinese medicine approach, biofeedback, guided imagery. All of these are designed for the sole purpose of when they get that urge to smoke, they replace it with a healthier stress reduction mechanism. So I tell patients, when you want, let's say you're at a party, you're at a nightclub, or you're at work, and you feel that urge to smoke, or maybe everyone's going outside for their smoke, and that's a really nice experience. Or maybe you need that time to kind of decompress. If you're at a party, you're socially anxious, and you want to just go outside and wind down, that if you go and instead replace it with taking nice, long, deep breaths, it's a natural stress reduction mechanism, and you tell yourself while you take deep breaths, things like, every moment, every breath I take, my lungs are clear when I don't smoke. So instead of actually breathing in nicotine and tar and carbon monoxide, I'm breathing in fresh air. My lungs are expanding. They're getting healthier every day. So remembering positive thoughts, taking long, deep breaths. So it serves the purpose of reducing anxiety through some sort of quick meditation that a patient can do on their own. And then it also reminds them that each day their lungs are getting stronger and healthier, that they don't smoke. And then we talked about assertiveness training, which is essentially a therapy where it will help patients, it will be designed to help them resist social pressures to smoke. So if someone tells you as a physician that the reason they have a hard time quitting is because everyone in their life smokes, then it's the goal would be to get them into some sort of assertiveness training. Dialectical behavioral therapy, by the way, if you have a patient who's borderline personality disorder, who smokes and engages in a lot of self-destructive or health risk behaviors, dialectical behavioral therapy addresses all of this. It has the stress management, it has the assertiveness training, all of this built in. So it's not, but if the problem is that it's really designed for borderline patients, but if there, you have a patient who's extremely difficult and might need more than you can offer in the session, just to keep in mind that dialectical behavioral therapy incorporates all of these. Okay, so designing a comprehensive treatment strategy. What we've talked about, so we've assessed physical dependence, we've assessed psychological and social determinants. We need to put all that together, because let's say the patient is now in the stage of change where they're ready for a plan, and they're saying, what's the plan, doctor? So what stage is that? Preparation. They're in the preparation stage. What's the plan? Now you need to take all the information you've gathered that they've given you, that you've worked as partners to generate. You want to take that and design your comprehensive treatment strategy. And with that, we'll take a break. So now you get your 10 minutes. We'll come back and we'll design our strategies for getting patients to quit. I need my clock here.
Question. About this. Yeah, this question.